Welcome to Holden Village. Today, Stixrud and Anderson will be speaking on balancing your life is more than an act. So let's listen in on Stixrud and Anderson.
I'd like to start with just asking you, and I think you're tired probably of sometimes sitting around and just being talked to, so let's talk a little bit about where we get our ideas on what is health, where we get our balance in life, what models we use, where some of our self-care attitudes come from. Does anyone have any ideas on that?
From our parents.
From our parents, okay.
From the media.
So, what kind of messages did you get from your parents?
How to do things right.
Did anybody else get messages like, if you don't put something on your head, you're going to get sinus problems? what else did you? If you're in an accident, you'll embarrass the whole family.
We never care.
And there's an ER nurse.
ER nurse, don't worry about it.
So you can just dispel that one myth that you've had from your parents. You don't need to wear clean underwear in case you're in an accident. There may be health reasons. What kind of messages do we get from our media about how our health should be and what our role models of health and wellness are?
You get a real mix.
What are some of the conflicting messages?
If you smoke, you look glamorous.
If you smoke, you look glamorous.
McDonald's likes you to eat their hamburger.
Right, something that just hits the spot and it just gives you what you need. Or
it keeps changing too. One time you're not supposed to eat butter, and now butter is better than margarine, and eggs too.
Eggs are good.
I think there's a sense, too, that health is vitality and all this robustness, and it's this almost a stressful, frenzied kind of, you know, being active to the point that you miss some of the calming kinds right. of things that lead to health, too.
How about the pop, pop, fizz, fizz? Oh, what a relief it is. You know, just if something's wrong, pop a pill, drink something that has medicinal value. If you're wanting to be popular, beer, wine coolers, those will do it. Those are really good things to keep our health and life in balance, aren't they? So we get a lot of messages, and I'd like you to think about what is wellness and wholeness from several perspectives. I'm going to be talking about four different issues regarding the philosophy and principles of holistic health. The first one, we'll talk about the person as a whole. What are some of the components? And then we'll talk about health as a process. We'll talk about prevention being central, and we'll talk a little bit about self-care. And then I'd like to actually go and give you some ideas on establishing programs for wholeness, wellness, so that we can look at not just knowing about it and knowing, oh, we've been bad, or there are some things we could have done better, but how can we realistically incorporate this into our lives? And the first thing I want to go over with you is that health is a lifelong process. When we look at ways of maintaining our sense of well-being or maximizing the quality of our lives, it's something that's ongoing, it's constantly changing, and at any time the body is working to keep itself in balance. You all know this, if you injure something, your body starts a healing process, the wound process starts taking over. If you contact a bug, your immune system starts kicking in and things start getting back to normal again. Although there are times, I think, in flu season where some of us doubt that it's really actively working. I think speaking from an instructor's point of view, we feel this every time the term is coming to an end and assignments are due and our students are dropping off like flies and their immune systems haven't touched base in weeks and they're just falling apart. And we have kind of a standing joke among faculty, we're not allowed to be sick until finals week is over. And then without a doubt over Christmas break or whatever break it is, faculty falls apart. You just kind of keep yourself going. And I think as parents, you probably have come across some of this too. So when disease occurs, we know that something's happened to cause the process to malfunction. And things like that we do to ourselves, like if you have consistently poor eating habits or you cheat on some of the things that keep you healthy, that throws the whole thing out of balance. There's a really good analogy that I came across recently about how we know whether our life is in perspective or not, and they compared it to a Polaroid picture. You know, when you first take that picture, you're anxious to see if it turned out and what it looks like and everything. First of all, you really can't see it, and then it's a little fuzzy. It doesn't come into sharp focus. It's a little blurry around the edges. And as we go through life, then the contrast in colors gets a little more definitive. We actually see the picture a little bit better, and we find out, you know, what our life is supposed to be like or what we have developed in our life. And we know that some pictures turn out better than others. And I kind of like that developing process when we talk about a lifelong process. We are constantly changing and adjusting our personal habits. We're constantly in the process of discovering our potentials and limitations. And we're constantly making different choices that will affect our values and priorities. I'm sure that most of you have heard the term holistic or whole person. What does that mean to you?
I heard it put it in the words of being a whole person, you are happy with yourself. You like yourself.
Okay.
You aren't depending on someone else to make you happy.
So it's a sense of contentedness, feeling like you're okay.
Okay. I would say not making such sharp distinctions between the body, the mind, and the spirit, but seeing the person as the totality of those things, and that everything affects. Illness in the body affects the spirit and the mind, and illness in the spirit and the mind affects the body.
That everything is interrelated. I think when I went to school many years ago at Lutheran General School of Nursing in Park Ridge, Illinois, where parish nursing eventually came out of, they talked about human ecology and how we are a part of our environment and we're affected and affect everything around us, our social aspect, our family, our intellect, our environment, etc., physical, emotional self. And I think I'd like to look at one concept that appeals to me and that we've used in letting people look at balances in their life, and that has to do with the concept of a wheel or a wellness wheel. And this wheel has 8 spokes, and the spokes would be physical, emotional, spiritual, psychological, vocational, environmental, and what did I miss? Spiritual, did I say that? And when you think of a wheel, think of a bicycle wheel. I think this gives you a better image. If the bicycle didn't have the spokes coming out and the tire around it, and you just had the hub, how would your ride be?
Oh, what would it be?
Well, it would probably go for a while on little tiny hubs. What happens the first time you get into a small rut?
Stay there.
You don't get out of it. Even the little things can throw you off balance. So by suspending it on spokes of even size, what we're doing is giving it more opportunity to roll smoothly. But what happens if some of the spokes are longer than others?
It's bumpy.
It's bumpy. We get a lopsided ride. We don't get where we're going very efficiently. And I think that image, to me, is very useful. I was going to have it on overhead, but there's a great deal of competitiveness for overheads today. But so I decided that we didn't need it, and I can just show you kind of the image. I think you can probably all see it. You don't need to really read what's here. The spokes all have to do with the things I mentioned: environmental, vocational, social, physical, emotional, intellectual, spiritual, and psychological. And if you just keep this picture in mind, if we have some of the spokes longer than others, we have problems. If all of them are well developed, then we get we are able to safely get over and efficiently get over whatever we have to do in life. So I'd like you to think for a minute on what are some of the components of, first of all, emotional health. What are things that make you emotionally healthy?
I think the ability ability to express emotion.
Mm-hmm. Instead of keeping it inside. Okay, good.
It's only important for women.
It's only important for women.
No!
I think we have... I think we have just spawned another week-long conference here. Anything else that you can think of with emotions?
The ability to recognize your emotions and reflect upon them.
Okay. The ability to recognize and reflect upon your emotions. What about self-esteem? Okay. Those are, you know, just a couple of things about each one. What about physical health? What are some components of physical health?
Exercise,
okay, regular exercise. Good diet. I missed whoever it was.
Clean environment.
Clean environment. Annette mentioned the in the 1800s how the environmental conditions were the major cause of disease in that period. A lot of the illnesses, unsafe water supplies, etc. Anything else?
Avoiding harmful foods, things like smoking.
Okay, avoiding things that we know to be unhealthy. What about psychological components? It's kind of hard. Sometimes we think of it very closely to emotional.
Being in a nurturing environment.
Okay, good. Being in a nurturing environment.
Having a supportive group of friends and family.
Someone that you can share with and feels for you and with you. Problem solving happens that way. What about environmental? We talked a little bit about that, environmental health.
I think about having people that accept your emotions around you. That's part of environmental health.
It is part of your environment, isn't it? Here at Holton, we hear a lot about environment, and I think all those components can be very, very healthy. How we take care of our gifts that were given to us, how we care for the land. I'd like to spend a little time on spiritual health. I think that's something we think about our spirituality. Sometimes we don't think of it as a health component. And when I think about spiritual health, I was very moved a couple of years ago as we had our conference, our annual nursing parish nursing conference in Portland. We were very fortunate to have a special guest from Korea, Dr. Susie Kim, who's a nursing professor. And she consented to do a session for our nurses in the evening. And she talked about, we usually hear of a pie-shaped chart or a wheel when we talk about wholeness and the different dimensions like wedges of a pie. And she said her different conception of this is if you look at a hand, and the whole palm of the hand would be the spiritual sense. Everything else radiates from the spiritual. And that has made such an impression on me that I think that model has affected the way I see things now. If your spiritual life is out of kilter, then it's going to affect how you function emotionally. It's going to affect your physical life and all of the other components. And I'd like you just to think of that as maybe an alternate way of thinking about it. So let's talk a little bit about some of the spiritual health components. The spiritual health that we have is not determined only by the rituals and dogmas of our church. But what it refers to is our innermost self, the core dimension that tells you who you are and whose you are, and where you come from, where you're going. This is where we get our values, our beliefs, our commitments. And the spiritual dimension of our life, of course, can be a very powerful resource for us. It can also be very devastating if it's out of kilter. And in nursing, we have one of our nursing diagnoses is spiritual distress. And that's something that I don't think we identify often enough, but it certainly can be a devastating component. Jesus' ministry was filled with incidents that connect the spiritual and the physical. What were the components of his healing, of his ministry when he healed? When Jesus healed, what was included in his healing?
Forgiveness.
Touch.
Faith.
Your faith has made you whole.
Acceptance.
acceptance. Do you see how that all ties together? And I'd like you to think about that as a very powerful part of being well. All the people that he healed were healed on the basis of their belief and their contrite hearts, and we're talking about their spiritual health. I'm going to give you some components of spiritual health. Hope, faith, meaning, commitment, patience, joy, courage, gratitude, love, and intimacy. Can you think of some signs of spiritual distress, the other side of that coin?
Anger.
Worry.
Worry.
Withdrawal.
Withdrawal from what?
From community,
could be from church, not going to church regularly, from withdrawal from people.
Devastation. Despair.
Fear. What happens to prayer life? Sometimes it stops. Sometimes it's like, I just can't get in touch with God because I just feel an emptiness. And so I'd like you to think about some of those as needing to be in balance when we talk about spiritual health. I'd like to read you a little... Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, you said that people who are healed in Scripture had evidence of faith first?
No, not necessarily faith, but many times when Christ healed, he would say, because you believe... your faith has made you whole.
It's not an always.
No, not.
I mean, you think of the Gerasene demoniac that...
Sure.
I mean, there was no evidence of faith whatsoever.
Right. But I think what Christ did is very often he saw the whole person, not just a portion of them that was physically ill.
He didn't do it the same way with everything.
Absolutely not. You know, there are many, many dimensions of healing, many dimensions of illness, actually. Okay, I'd like to read you something that was actually written by a parish nurse. It's called Oh, Mr. Tentmaker. Have any of you heard that?
Only what?
Oh, Mr. Tentmaker. Oh, Mr. Tentmaker, it was nice living in this tent when it was strong and secure and the sun was shining and the air was warm. But Mr. Tentmaker, it's scary now. My tent is acting like it's not going to hold together. The poles seem weak and they shift with the wind. A couple of the stakes have wriggled loose from the ground, and worse of all, the canvas has a rip. It no longer protects me from beating rain or stinging flies. It's scary in here, Mr. Tentmaker. Last week I was sent to the repair shop, and some repairmen tried to patch the rip in my canvas. It didn't help much, though, because the patch pulled away from the edges, and now the tear is worse. What troubled me most, Mr. Tentmaker, is that the repairmen didn't seem to notice I was still in the tent. They just worked on the canvas while I shivered inside. I cried out once, but no one heard me. I guess my first real question is, why did you give me such a flimsy tent? I can see by looking around the campground that some of the tents are much stronger and more stable than mine. Why, Mr. Tentmaker, did you pick a tent of such poor quality for me? And even more important, what do you intend to do about it? Oh, little tent dweller, as creator and provider of tents, I know all about you and your tent, and I love you both. I made a tent for myself once and lived in it on your campground. My tent was vulnerable too, and some vicious attackers ripped it to pieces while I was still in it. It was a terrible experience, but you'll be glad to know they couldn't hurt me. In fact, the whole occurrence was a tremendous advantage because it's this very victory over my enemy that frees me to be of present help to you. Little tent dweller, I am now prepared to come and live in your tent with you, if you will invite me. You will learn as we dwell together that real security comes from my being in your tent with you. When the storms come, you can huddle in my arms and I'll hold you. When the canvas rips, we'll go to the repair shop together. Someday, little tent dweller, your tent will collapse, for I've designed it only for temporary use. When it does, you and I will leave together. I promise not to leave before you do. Then, free of all that would hinder or restrict, we will move to our permanent home together and forever rejoice and be glad. And that's by Rosalind Aronson. Okay, I'd just like to say a few more words about the whole person, the environment. I'm going to include in that the American way of life and doing things. And I would like you to think for a minute on where we learn to live, behave, celebrate, work, play. When we celebrate, what do we customarily do?
Eat.
Low calorie, high fiber, low fat. Not. It has to have lots of goo on it and fat and all those things. And don't we wash it down with something alcoholic and have a big party? Well, okay. Many of the ways that we're taught by the by our friends, family, TV, etc., are not terribly healthy ways. What about learning how to work? Our work ethic. What do you do to make it at work?
Work as hard as you can.
As hard as you can.
What if?
As fast as you can. What if you can't get it all done?
Stay later.
Stay late. Bring your work home. Keep drinking the coffee. Right? And probably not eating right, getting by on less sleep, and whatever else we need to do. I read something again that I really liked. It said most of the current American health epidemics are related primarily to the way we live. We get them the old-fashioned way. We earn them. The average American way, though, is not the the only option. I'd like to read to you a thing called The Pathology of Normalcy, and this is by Eric Hipp. In our culture, it's normal to eat when we're not hungry, to be overweight, to be overfat, to take the elevator, to drive around in the parking lot for 5 minutes to avoid a one-minute walk. In fact, in our culture, most people don't ever move faster than a walk unless it's absolutely necessary. Most normals prefer to watch others being physically active while they sit and consume large quantities of saturated fat, sugar, salt, and mood-altering chemicals. To be normal in our culture is to eat and drink a broad variety of chemicals, some of which cause disease in laboratory animals. Many normals do not enjoy food that doesn't taste like salt and will often salt a whole meal before tasting it. It's also common for normals to reward their children's positive behaviors with massive doses of concentrated sugar. Many normals are addicted to a brown, bitter-tasting water that makes them feel anxious. To obscure this bitterness of the beverage, many will add saturated fat and sugar. Some normals inhale the smoke and tar of burning leaves, fully conscious of the fact that this behavior will shorten their lives and the lives of others around them by many years. For 2 or 3 hours a day, normals will blankly stare at a small screen showing images of violence, artificial humor, and unhealthy lifestyles. It's common that human interaction in many homes is confined to 60-second intervals between 15-minute periods of staring blankly at the small screen. On the same screen before going to bed, normals will absorb half an hour of all the bad news that happened in their community and in the world, and then read about it all the next morning in the newspaper before starting for work. Normals never really relax because they don't know how. It's considered normal in our culture to be occupied or preoccupied for all of your waking hours. Those who slow down are considered daydreamers and invited to feel non-productive. This pace of living guarantees a high degree of stress for the normal person. Because of unmanaged stress, it's common for many normals to dramatically alter their mood with chemicals and then drive 2 tons of metal at high speed, believing they are competent. Because of the stress in their lives, it's difficult for normals to be playful. To avoid this stress, many normal individuals have adapted to a high degree of routine in their lives and do not willingly invite challenges. In fact, many normals do not expect to experience joy or contentment on any regular basis and go through life just getting by. It's common for normals to have many acquaintances but few intimate friends. They are the products of go it alone, be tough, don't show your pain, pioneer spirit of their forebears, which invites them not to be real in their relationships and to feel cut off from others. Normals do not expect their life to be a lot of fun or extremely challenging after the first few years. For most, work is what they do for money and the benefits. Normals believe someone else will fix things that go wrong. For example, if they get sick or injured as a result of their lifestyle choices, medical science will repair them, and their employer will be responsible for the cost. They also feel if they vote once a year, the world will be okay. Normals do not know much of health and well-being or how to create those conditions, so when they try to change their living habits, they start out enthusiastically, but almost always fail. After a few attempts, most normals quit trying and resign themselves to the way they are. All normals surround themselves with other normals who have similar values and behaviors. These people offer support to the normal person and help them resist any significant change in their living habits. As a result of this support, normal people continue to be and feel normal. Because of the foregoing, normals in our culture miss out much of the vitality, personal growth, joy, and contentment they are capable of experiencing, and they die 2 to 10 years before they have to. All of this is normal in our culture. So, enough said. I just left up from the other night the fact that what changes our health, personal lifestyle choices, 50% account for 50% of what is important in our life. The medical care system is responsible for maybe 10%, our environment and heredity equally about 20%. So you can see the enormous amount of change we can make if we look at our own health. Something that I can't show you because I don't have an overhead, but it's just fun. This is Frank and Ernest. Do any of you ever read Frank and Ernest? There's a prescription pharmacy, and one of them, I can't remember who it is saying, an ounce of prevention comes to $20.95. So you can imagine what a pound of cure would cost. Okay, a couple more things about the holistic approach, and then we'll move on to what we can do about it. We talk about making sure that we don't try to just treat symptoms of what's wrong, but that we look at the person that's involved. And then one of the things that I mentioned was prevention. And I'd like to add to that, prevention, when we talk about prevention of disease, we can do that by giving somebody shots. You know, you get your flu shot, so hopefully you'll prevent something from happening that takes you away from work for a few days in the fall. I'd like to add to that promotion of health, because that's a little bit more active approach. And we know that we can actually alter this by our behaviors. Are you up for another story? I want you to see if you know this person. On the morning of her 42nd birthday, Carrie Moore awoke to a peal of particularly ominous thunder. Glancing out the window with bleary eyes, she saw written in fiery letters across the sky, "Someone is trying to kill you, Carrie Moore." With shaking hands, Carrie lit her first cigarette of the day. She didn't question the message. You don't question a message like that. Her only question was, who? At breakfast, as she salted her fried eggs, she told her husband, Larry, "Someone's trying to kill me." "Who?" he asked in horror. Carrie slowly stirred the cream and sugar into her coffee and shook her head. "I don't know," she said. Convinced though she was, Carrie couldn't go to the police with such a story. She decided that her only course was to go about her daily routine and hope somehow to outwit her would-be murderer. She made the family lunches, picked up some clothes to take to the cleaners, wrote out a check for her daughter's class pictures. After dropping the kids off at school, she tried to think about the message on her drive to the office. But now she was late, and the frustration of making time by beating lights and switching lanes occupied her wholly. Nor once behind her desk could she find a moment, with jangling phones, urgent memos, and the problems and decisions piling up as they did every day. It wasn't until her second margarita at lunch that the full terror of the position struck her. It was all she could do to finish her lasagna Milanese. "I can't panic," she said, lighting another cigarette. "I simply must live life as usual." So she worked until 6 as usual, drove home fast as usual, gulped out a fast food dinner as usual, took her daughter to her lesson as usual, picked up her son from Cub Scouts as usual, had her 2 usual glasses of wine, studied her business reports as usual, then took 2 sleeping pills in order to get her usual 6 hours sleep. As the days passed, she courageously stuck to her routine, and as the months went by, she began to take perverse pleasure in her ability to survive. "Whoever's trying to get me," she'd proudly say to her husband, "hasn't got me yet. I'm too smart for him." "Please be careful," he'd reply, passing her a second helping of beef stroganoff. Her pride grew as she managed to go on living. But as it must to all persons, death came at last to Carrie. It came to her desk on a particularly busy. Her grief-stricken widow demanded a full autopsy. But it showed only, emphysema, arteriosclerosis, duodenal ulcers, cirrhosis of the liver, cerebrovascular aneurysm, pulmonary edema, obesity, circulatory insufficiency, and a touch of cancer. How glad Carrie would have been, said her widower, to know that she died of natural causes. Okay, what is self-care? What is taking care of ourselves? I think probably most of you remember Romans 12:1. Therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. And we know that research shows that the biggest factor affecting our health is lifestyle, and the smallest factor is medical care. So we have actually some biblical injunctions. Another one, 1 Corinthians 10:31. So whether you eat or drink, do everything for the glory of God. That sound familiar? So why self-care? We've talked some the other night about the importance of looking at getting into your own health management. It wasn't until the last 15 or 20 years that we've given much serious thought to it. We always let the medical profession take care of us. And now we're starting to look at our own personal responsibility. But more than that, it's important for the church to look at the responsibility to the least of those among us and helping to take care of those around us. Just like to not overwhelm you with statistics, but just give you one slice when we're looking at disease prevention and promotion of health. Over $65 billion annually is spent by our healthcare system on smoking-related illnesses, more than $16 billion a year on the treatment of alcohol and drug abuse. However, the total economic impact of drug and alcohol abuse is greater than $110 billion annually. This includes treatment, premature death, accidents, crime, and lost productivity. Between 50 to 70% of women who abuse substances receive little or no prenatal care and are prone to poor nutrition. And they estimate that if all pregnant women refrained from smoking, fetal and infant deaths would decrease by approximately 10%. So that would be around 400 infants a year that would be affected by that. According to the American Academy of Family Physicians, 2/3 of office visits to family doctors are prompted by stress-related symptoms. You've all heard, I guess as early as biology classes, about the fight or flight syndrome. What does that refer to? Anyone remember?
The body's response, or any animal response to danger, is due to its physical response of adrenaline and so forth to either fight off the attacker or
to run away or to fight. Now let's take that into our modern society, and the boss has just told you something devastating or told you you were doing a poor job. So your options are probably not to run out of the office and flee or to punch him out. So instead of that, we've adapted. What do we do instead?
Try to bury it.
Stuff it, bury it, okay? Keep it internal. Scapegoat.
Go smoke a cigarette.
Go smoke a cigarette. Have a drink. Two Twinkies. Whatever your style is, but we don't deal with it directly, do we? Actually, if you look at stress, the stress is going to be there, but how we deal with it is known to be one of the major contributors, directly or indirectly, to the 6 leading causes of death in the United States. And those would include coronary heart disease, cancer, lung ailments, accidental injuries, suicide, and cirrhosis. And it can also aggravate many other conditions. So we look at our lifestyle being a principal cause of many diseases. The 3 most prescribed drugs in our country, does anyone want to guess what these are?
Valium
is one. Valium for anxiety, Tagamet for ulcers, and Inderal for blood pressure.
Isn't that just amazing? Does that tell you something about lifestyle? And what pushes us to this, another transparency that I'd like to share with you, but you'll just have to believe what it says, and I'll tell you, I'll interpret for you. This is Superwoman, and I'm not going to just single out women. I'll give something to the men later. The common traps we fall into, and Superwoman is what we're all supposed to be, right? Superwoman has no wrinkles, perfect makeup, she's always smiling, she always says the right thing. She has no plaque. She's the perfect wife and mother. She always gets things done. She bakes homemade cookies. She has a flat tummy, no cellulite. She's dressed for success by day and Fredericks of Hollywood by night. She's financially independent. She's involved in community affairs. She never has a run in her pantyhose. And she has sweet-smelling feet. So just one idea, but if we don't do it to ourselves with our expectations, somebody will do it for us, and I like this one too. This is my daughter, who started at the bottom of her company and rose to be become a supervisor in only 2 years. She set the national sales record this year, has been asked to join the board of directors, and whose house is a mess. I don't know where I went wrong. So we get messages. What are some of the common things that give us stress?
All the strains on your time, trying to raise a family and work and do housework and be involved with your church.
Too much to do.
Too much to do, too little time, too few hours in a day.
And if they gave us more hours, what would we do?
Fill them up.
Maybe we have unrealistic goals for ourselves because there's so much that we could possibly accomplish. So many choices, so much to manage. Okay. So we have to learn how to manage some of this. I told you I wasn't going to leave the men off the hook. Some of you may be able to relate to this, and this is not just designed for men, but have any of you read Slow Down Moses? This is taken from there. It's called Jethro. Now, men with hefty power drives are seldom heroes to their wives. The man who leads a busy life has little time for home or wife. Spouses do not have a yen to join in praising famous men. They give success a cool reception, and Zipporah was no exception. The placid Moses whom she married was tired, edgy, tense, and harried. And she suspected he was very ready for a coronary. And so, she felt, 'twas time she had a little chat with Mom and Dad. She journeyed where her parents dwelt and told her folks just how she felt. I didn't want a bed of roses when I agreed to marry Moses. I know it takes a lot of gall to argue with a holy call, but Moses, as you clearly see, has time for God, but not for me. I cry myself to sleep at night. Tell me, do you think that's right? It caused those parents great distress to see their child's unhappiness. And Jethro, dear Zipporah's dad, was more than just a trifle mad. This time, the time he thought was overdue to teach the boy a thing or two. Jethro's temper rankled raw as he sought his son-in-law. But then he saw, to his dismay, how Moses spent the working day. People came from far and near in hopes of catching Moses' ear. No problem was too small to mention. They brought them all to his attention. The sheer amount of people who were waiting for an interview caused Jethro to feel rather dizzy. My son-in-law is much too busy. I think I'll play a bit of Cupid. That boy's not bad. He's simply stupid. And so, I'm happy to relate, Jethro told it to him straight. Whoever said you were commanded to run this country single-handed? You know, you're just the protege of God who rests the seventh day. Why, you've become, that's very odd, more indispensable than God. This schedule you are keeping will put you to bed in Ulcerville. That's a price we can't afford, so get some help, thus saith the Lord. Under Jethro's gentle nudges, Moses chose some able judges and discovered to his glee they did the job as well as he. There's ample help for any task once we have the sense to ask. Just a few points. When you look at Jesus' ministry, He didn't do it by himself, did he? He called others to help him. He had a close group of friends he could talk with. He exercised regularly. He walked. Did you see the distances he walked? He replenished himself. He ate healthily.
But somebody always cooked his meals.
Somebody cooked his meals. He was honest. He prayed often. He periodically sought solitude. He was open to all people. He trusted. He did God's will. He loved. He went about his work despite all his problems, but he looked to others for support, but not to take care of him. So just a few things that you might want to look at for an example. Okay. Just a little bit about our moral responsibility as Christians. I have to relate to you a story that C. Everett Koop told. It was a particularly busy day, and he had a really heavy call schedule. His children were sick, his wife wasn't feeling too good, and they had a house guest, and that house guest in the course of the day delivered a premature baby precipitously in their home. The whole house was up for grabs. They were running around, and their live-in housekeeper was nowhere to be found. And finally, after 10 hours, they found her, and they said, "Where have you been?" And her answer was, "I knew you were having a terrible day, and so I stayed in my room and prayed for you."
That's a true story.
It's a true story. Yeah. And he gave that as a point of saying, sometimes as Christians, we think that the only thing we should do is just offer to pray, but not actually help people when they're needing it. So with that, I'd like to just talk a little bit about your responsibility. The explosion of health information that we have when we look at self-care, we can do a lot of good by looking at what we need to do, what we need to help those around us do, but we can also get the wrong perspective, and sometimes we can use health as an end instead of a means to an end, and the means to the end being that we're able to live our lives more fully in Christ's service and to use our bodies wisely as a living sacrifice. But if it's out of perspective, we can really go awry. I have one more cartoon that some of you may have seen, and these are, I can't show you that one, two leaves hanging on the tree, and one of them says to each other, "Why do we fall from the tree and die anyway?" Well, the way I understand it, when fall comes, changes begin to occur in the cells where the stem is attached to the branch, and the vessels which supply us with nourishment become plugged with gums, causing us to wither and fall from the tree. The next leaf says, "That isn't going to happen to me. I jog."
Oh.
So can we change everything in our lives just by understanding what happens? No, we have a course that we have to run, and what we can do is use it to our best advantages. Wellness can be wonderful. It can make us feel better, look better, act better, be more social people, but it also can be a set of rules. Thou shalt do this, thou shalt jog, thou shalt eat well, thou shalt never have fatty foods. And what I'd like you to look at is what we're trying to accomplish is being the best we can be so that we're fulfilling God's purpose. So many times we think of this as another set of rules, and I'd like us to look at using our health in a gospel perspective rather than a law perspective. Does that make sense? Just not another sense of thou shalt, but what it's actually doing for us. There's a little cartoon. "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, and a sense of humor when I don't know the difference." Sometimes looking at the humor in our lives will help us keep things in perspective. Another thing that I just wanted to have us look at is when we're looking at how we can help each other and help ourselves get more healthy, I'm reminded of the Bible verse that says, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." And if you look at that, there are several dimensions to that too. You really have to love and care for yourself and be in good shape before you can be of good shape to be anyone else. But I think we also have to keep a perspective of when we're sharing, when we're doing things within our churches, within our families, keep in mind who we're serving, whose ministry is it. Sometimes no matter what we're doing, we can be in a serving mode and we can be caretakers, taking the responsibility fully instead of caregivers where we're sharing and where we're doing for each other until we get so burned out that we're getting our jollies by doing, 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 and it's actually a pathological doing where we're neglecting other aspects of our life. If you can think of that as maybe we're busy taking care of some of our needs, but our physical spoke is a little bit shorter. Our family spoke gets shorter because we're not there to do anything with our families, and all of those things have to be in perspective. Okay, does anyone have any comments or questions? I'd like to share some resources with you and talk a little bit about that. Any questions or comments? We have a few more minutes. Well, what would you like to? Yes, there are many guides, and that's one thing I'd like to talk about now. There are some things for helping yourself and for helping people, perhaps in a support group in a congregation, work together on wellness. I have a list that I can share with you. One of the things that I read from when we were talking about normal people is a book called Structured Exercises for Wellness Promotion. Oh, I didn't bring the other one. The authors are the Tubesings, T-U-B-E-S-I-N-G, and they have a marvelous book that we use for, actually we give it to all our parish nurses that take the parish nurse introductory class, and it's called Keeping Your Healthy Balance. And strongly recommend that. It's a kind of a workbook that you can look at for getting into the different aspects of your own health and seeing that you're in balance, and particularly that you're not going overboard in one area. There are some excellent guides. One of them is, and I'd like to refer you also, some of you have seen the newsletters from Holden Village. There's an excellent one that was written by Gail Bongard, who has attended our parish nurse class, and it looks like this. It's March 94, and it's Health and Spirituality. It's a very nicely written article, and I would suggest that you look through it. It's only a few pages. Some of the church benevolent associations will have good resources. Aid Association for Lutherans has a terrific packet of wellness materials called Well Now, and they will supply your churches with a number of materials that there are members in that congregation. The Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Mennonites, many of the groups have supplies that are very similar. Actually, this one I'm not going to recommend. It's Lutheran Brotherhood, and it's called Ways Toward Wellness, and I didn't find that particularly helpful. And they have very few materials, but Aid Association for Lutherans does have a nice packet. Annette, why don't you mention, you're familiar with the LaFia Guide.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with Dick Cardell. He's written a manual for congregations, and it's probably the best guide I have seen, and it's called It's for Life, L-I-F-E, and each letter's, I know the first one is lifestyle, but I can't remember what the other two stand for, and I guess because we were carrying so many books up here, that was one that got left out, but I strongly recommend it. And what I am talking about tomorrow, it really has to do with assets for youth. And Dick Cardell is also working in that area with Search Institute. And he's becoming one of my favorite people as far as trying to give congregations good materials to work with. He has a retreat planned in his It's for Life. He does the components of wellness. H-A-R-T-E-L-L. And I'll look, I think
We have a bibliography list that you can look at afterwards. I'm sorry, I don't have enough copies
and
for
everyone. Is there a number?
Yes, there is.
He's also
a phone number.
Yes. He does clown ministry. Yeah.
It's great.
And did you want to say something about the Lafayette Guide?
If any of you were here the other day, you were introduced to David Hilton, who was a missionary in Nigeria for many years. And he went over as a surgeon. And for, I think it was 10 years, he watched people come in the front door, he'd fix them, they'd go out the back door, they'd be back in again. And he said, you know, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, that instead of keeping people out of the hospital, we're just letting them get sick and we fix them up and send them out for them to get sick again. And so he spent quite a few years then in Nigeria talking about wellness, health and wellness. And eventually then went to Geneva and was part of the Christian Medical Commission in Geneva. Put out a wonderful, I became acquainted with him in India because he put out such a wonderful guide for third world countries on talking about wellness. And now he's in this country and, you know, he runs into that same kind of frustration that I have always felt coming back here, and that's, why, what is it that people don't know take some responsibility for their health, which is what we're really, what Christian missionaries are doing in other countries is teaching them to take care of their health because they don't have enough money to be hospitalized. There aren't enough personnel to take care of them. And so you work on the wellness end of things and you see that that is the way to do things. And the Lafayette Guide is a guide that has come through Tom Drogi. If any of you are familiar, he was at Valpo. And David Hilton. It's a congregational handbook for whole person health ministry. You might want to just glance through this. This also has a tape that goes with it. And we find that many of our parish nurses like to use this.
I just wanted to show you that actually by turning around, by looking at self-care and looking at a self-care model, we can actually impact how our healthcare dollars are being spent. I don't know how many of you can see this, but if we have a system that has no emphasis on self-care, what we're doing is spending about 84% of our time is spent on office visits, 13% of our time is spent in hospitals, and 3% of our care is given in teaching hospitals, research hospitals. And this accounts for 15% of the healthcare dollars, 45% of the healthcare dollars, and 40% of the healthcare dollars. In the self-care model, if people are keeping healthy and they're taught how to have prevention, health promotion, this actually comes to, oh, I lost the number, 80. I think it's 86%. Somebody can have to do the math for me. Office-based care is still very important, but we have only 2.6% of the care actually in the hospitals and 0.6% in the critical care, the high-risk, the teaching hospitals. So I think it's important for us to look at what we're doing in our congregations right now. There is health ministry going on in your congregations, whether you know it or not, but it probably hasn't been labeled as such, or it may not. But you can look at things like, does your congregation support or have support groups? That's part of wellness. Does your congregation look at, oh, maybe programs for single persons or widows? And all of those things, if there's an intentional program on what are the needs of a person holistically or the whole person, and having an intentional ministry that can support that, you can be more effective. And one way that we have found is very effective is having a health ministry program, a health ministry team or cabinet, and a parish nurse who coordinates that. And that's the whole idea, is putting it together in an intentional ministry. What are some things your churches are doing now in regard to health and healing and wholeness?
Emmanuel Lutheran in Longview, Washington, does have a singles group, which is part of called Frontier. Mm-hmm. And it's for anybody who's single, whether they're divorced, widowed, or whatever. And the age group of that is generally from about 30 to 50.
Mm-hmm. A significant segment of the population, a significant segment of the age group. Anything else that you're doing? We found that one thing that I suggested in our church is that every usher should be trained to know CPR in case something happened. And I had an interesting response I was sharing yesterday with Cheryl, that I asked the usher, the head of the ushers, because there was a person in our church that heads the education department for the American Red Cross, and he offered to do the classes at a very minimal cost. The usher captain said, it's not necessary for our ushers to be trained in CPR because they know which services the doctors attend and where they're sitting. So in case somebody would have a problem, they just call the doctor that was in church that time. But I think, you know, things like that, looking at safety factors around the congregation, looking at maybe during Nutrition Month, which is October, having for coffee hour some healthy treats and having recipes that go with them so people can see they actually can taste good and take them home with them. Looking at blood pressure screening. Looking at, if you have a community of faith and people that are together in a faith community with similar values, what better place for them to develop better lifestyle habits based on their values and their faith and supporting each other rather than, we mentioned this the other night, rather than just going to a group at the Y or at the hospital where you never see those people again after the class ends. And so those are ways that you can support each other and encourage people to use their gifts for ministry, and also to help people recognize when they're becoming addicted to caregiving, when they're in over their head, having to share that caregiving rather than just everybody burning out because there are only a few people in the church that do it, supporting each other through that, having loss support groups. And those sorts of things. Well, there are many things that can happen, and there are also many resources. And if you'd like some more information, please see Annette or me. And thank you very much for coming.